Talk given Sunday, 23rd September, 1973. We all know the different ways in which man has been described. Aristotle's term, political animal. Rousseau's term, social animal. Marx's term, economic animal. I have always preferred to regard man fundamentally as a religious being, not merely as an animal, because man is different from all the other animals. He's a religious being fundamentally. And the three different kinds of animals which he has been called, political, social, economic, are merely accessory, very secondary to this fundamental fact of man being a religious being. And it is this which has to come to fruition, the religiousness in him, which will spell the fruition of him as man. Let us very briefly touch upon what we call the social sense. Man has had a social sense for a very, very long time indeed in his history. And this social sense, something which is innate in him, and something which history and the growth of civilization, civilized communities and so forth, has compelled him to develop. Perhaps particularly in our own time, our own age, this social sense is trying to find expression. And it is meeting with considerable difficulty in trying to find right expression in the name of what is commonly called socialism or humanitarianism or anything you like. Much that is unsocial and inhuman is done. We talk about the brotherhood of man. It's an ideal. It's an intellectual perception. It is also something deep in people's hearts, the brotherhood of man. But in which sense is man conscious of this brotherhood? He is not conscious of it in terms of a brotherhood of religious beings. But he is conscious of it in terms of men as social, as political or social or economic animals. His awareness is superficial. And although his sensitivity is strong, he does not understand the true nature of this sensitivity. Therefore, he cannot truly educate this social sense. This is something which is very important in the practical life of man today. The world population has increased at a very great rate and is still increasing at an almost alarming rate. And unless this awareness of one's fellow man as a religious being comes to fruition, to clear consciousness, to use the Buddha's phrase, clear consciousness, unless that takes place, man will be up against almost insuperable difficulties. So difficult, in fact, that he will possibly continue to destroy himself, as he has done through the ages, because of wars. Now, how does man awake to this profounder sensitivity which lies at the very root of true social living? We must recognize first and foremost that the fundamental duality which separates us from our fellow beings lies within us, the self and the not-self. We are conscious in terms of this fundamental duality, and we live by it willy-nilly. And as long as this fundamental duality operates in our own being, and we cannot produce, release a true harmony within ourselves with respect to self and not self, all talk about the brotherhood of man, or the still more inclusive concept, the unity of life, remains at the level of talk, remains at the level of wishful thinking. It cannot be carried out in practice because we are incapable of doing so. And we are incapable of doing so because we ourselves, each one of us individually, is divided in himself. The self, the self-consciousness, and the consciousness of the not-self. The basic duality. And we live in terms of a conflict always between self and not self. See what happens to us, however nice our feelings may be and our desires to help our fellow human beings and so forth, to serve them and make everybody happy, including ourselves. See what happens when the circumstance becomes sufficiently provocative. We are toppled over, we hit out. There is war, there is destruction. So you see, if we are really concerned with a religious life, we have, as always, to come back right into our own selves. And each one of us, the microcosm, is a miniature of the macrocosm. We have to come right back to ourselves and from within our own beings release the harmony of self and not self. Then, howsoever we function, in thought, in speech, in action, in daily life, will necessarily carry that power and strength for harmonizing which is due to the harmony which we ourselves have established in our own being. This is where what we commonly call one's own self is of primary importance. Because if one's own self is not there, so to say, there is no you to do anything at all. You have to be there in order to do. A Buddha had to be there in order to spread enlightenment. A Christ had to be there in order to spread the teaching of grace and mercy and all the rest of it. But note carefully, they themselves embodied superlatively, in perfection, that which they taught. Now, this thing we call the social sense and the feeling of brotherhood. This sensitivity, which exists in all of us in some measure or other, is not strong enough, and also it's not intelligent enough. It is a thought, a superficial thought. And as a superficial thought, it is somewhat impotent. It hasn't got the warmth of surging life within it to express itself in the world of affairs and express itself in a stable way, in a creative way. Let us then try to look into ourselves for a few minutes and see if we can release this sensitivity, let it grow stronger, and let it release intelligently. Most of you are acquainted with what we have tentatively called the Earth Meditation. Let us just start off with that now. So let both body and mind be at ease. Breathe easily and let your own life rhythm establish itself. Peacefully, happily. Let the mind be clearly aware that each one of us is oneself to start with. This body, this rupa, with its associated feelings and thoughts and consciousness and so on, is a focus point for a growing awareness. And starting with ourselves and seeing ourselves in a state of peace and harmony, a state which means that each of us is a unified whole. Let the mind be strongly aware of that. The whole organism, the nama rupa, is a unified whole, free of conflict. The senses pacified, and desire stilled, so that it doesn't intrude upon the right activity of the mind. Now just let us be aware that oneself is not the end of the story. What we commonly call ourself is reflected in what we commonly call other selves. Every one of us in this room consists of individuals who are unique but in perfect relationship. This is the important point. There is a factual relationship between all of us. There is the material body, as we call it, feelings, thoughts, functioning, the life process. It's all of the same nature. Be intensely aware of that. We are in actual fact one great body. And at this moment, we are participating in a group meditation. At this time of the day, it's more or less tea time, as we say. And perhaps for people dwelling in this longitude, north degrees for London, let us assume that it is tea time from the North Pole to the South Pole in our hemisphere. And so people will be more or less active in that way. And we are all in relationship, although we are not conscious of it, because our senses cannot penetrate very far. But the mind, the intellect can know it, that this is so. And try, just let the mind picture the sort of social interaction that goes on at tea time. And then swiftly, let us move further eastwards or westwards, whichever you please, and note that there are different times of the day at this very moment, this very second, in different parts of the world. And they will be doing different things. And if we go ahead 6 hours or more in one direction, most people will be fast asleep. If we go westwards the other direction, they will be getting up in the morning. And so let the mind encircle the globe that way and be very intensely aware now that the human race as a whole at this instant is doing all the things that human beings do, good, bad, indifferent, boring, exciting, everything is happening simultaneously. This is a very important point. feel it. Think out only a few outstanding details. The pleasant things, the horrible things, they are all happening now. Birth, death, growing up, everything is happening now. And let the mind feel intensely that each one of us, I myself, am part and parcel of this total life of mankind. I am part and parcel of it. So the man who is kidnapping or murdering another person is me, myself, doing it. The man who is in profound meditation is me, myself, doing it, and so forth. Be very sensitive to this. Let the mind concentrate on it, dwell upon it. Not praising the so-called good doer, not condemning the so-called evil doer. Each of them undoubtedly is a good doer or evil doer, where one just sees the fact without praising, without condemning, without attachment, without aversion. Observe it both coolly with the intellect and feel it strongly, warmly with the heart. This is important, the two together. And if and when you practice this by yourself and let the mind stay quietly in this condition, you will find this mysterious thing called compassion welling out. Remember, compassion is the mediator between mercy, complete forgiveness and so forth on the one hand, and judgment and punishment on the other hand. It's the mediator between the two. And its nature is transcendent, something which we don't really know. You will find this feeling welling out very calmly, quietly, powerfully, unemotionally, unsentimentally. That is why karuna, compassion, and particularly mahakaruna, the great compassion, is always associated with upekha, equanimity of mind, perfect poise of mind. Now, in this still state, hold all humanity within one's own heart. It is for me to endure the evil of the wrongdoer. It is for me to absorb and intensify the good of the good doer. And in this way, the social sense is made to grow, is allowed to grow in religious terms. Because the religious context is an inclusive context. Nothing is excluded. And in this way, the power of the social feeling in one's inner being can work beneficently in one's immediate environment and further afield according to the strength of that feeling. All right, now just rest a few moments. Our growth and development is what we may call a body-mind growth and development. A coming to fruition of the particular organism, the particular being as such. Now, any coming to fruition is thwarted unless one is able to set one's sights correctly. Then you know how to steer this organism in its journey, not through time and space, but through eternity, through that which transcends all mind, time and space. And if we set our sights right there, then all this else which we do comes to full fruition. Now, we cannot set our sets right by the use of intellect alone. But we have no means of communication bar the intellect with its instrument of speech, words. You and I can't communicate otherwise with each other. We haven't the power that the Buddha and his disciples had, that Jesus had. Because time and again in the New Testament you'll find the same statement. Jesus knew with his mind what was in the minds of the others. You and I haven't developed that power. Some of you may have, I don't know. But certainly not sufficiently for clear communication. So our communication is at least of a nature which has lost at least one important dimension. So we must make do with the best that we have. Words and the exercise of the intellect. But having heard the words and understood with the intellect, then let it come to fruition in the deeper way through your innermost sensitivity in your own being. Now, you have often heard me say, the context of religion is transcendence. Transcendence is the root. transcendence is the seed. It is the tree. It is the flower. It is everything. This is the marvel of transcendence. And it is all this in simultaneity. There is no time process involved where transcendence is concerned. There is no such thing as continuity in time where transcendence is concerned. There is no sameness. There is everlasting newness, because the nature of reality, transcendence, is this extraordinary creative pulsation of life, other life, being, non-being. I can't go beyond that in speaking about it. Otherwise, one couldn't explain. One has to have a certain amount of contrasting conceptions, being, non-being. This creative pulse of transcendence is the eternal fact of reality. You will have to try to sort of get hold of it intellectually first. That cannot be avoided. This pulsation, which is ever new, never repetitious, goes on at an incredible rapidity all the time. The totality pulses like that, just as scientists have discovered that energy goes out in pulses like that and not as a continuous river flowing past. And it is this sense of the pulsation which we must attempt to release within ourselves. It's very difficult. But if you can once feel that pulse within yourself with this incredible rapidity, get into touch with it, then you are in touch with the very origin of that power which brings into being and manifests a universe all the time. We see this universe only in terms of time and space, as a long process, a becoming process. But every split second, and by split second I mean 100,000 millionth of a second, every split second like that, the total universe is being recreated. And every recreation is a new thing. This is what we can't get as human beings. Don't ask me why and how I say this. I don't know, but it came that way. That's all. You get this extraordinary sense of this creative pulsation of life, other life. Now let us just consider this word life for a few moments. We are conscious of life only in terms of multiplicity. This is a living thing, that is a living thing, this person, that animal, that tree. And then we say that there is the inanimate world. This is a mistake. There is no such thing as the inanimate world. The entire universe is animate. It's alive. And even modern science has propounded that idea now, that the total universe is alive all the time. But we are aware of this aliveness in terms of multiplicity. This is the shortness of our vijnana, our consciousness, we are incapable. However, if we once see the idea and get hold of the idea, then we'll see that this multitudinous manifestation which constitutes the universe and which is composed, let us say, just use one word for convenience, of so many beings, we'll call a stone, a tree, a flower, a human being, we'll call them all beings, just for convenience, you see. Each one of these beings goes back into non-being, not as an entity. All entityness completely disappears. If you really meditate and can really become aware of the full meaning of the Buddha's teaching, particularly about the skandhas, rupa, vedana, sanya, sankhara, vijnana, how none of them persists, everything disrupts, you see. The question arises, well, what does it become? It doesn't become anything. The being is afterwards non-being. Now, obviously, beings are multitudinous in number. Non-being is only one. Just as space is only one. There are 2, 3 million, a billion, trillion spaces? Not at all. Just one space. The one total reality space. And it is characterless. You see? It's beyond description. It's nondescript. So non-being is like that. And never forget, the Buddha himself has used this extraordinary phrase with regard to consciousness. Vijnana, which he says, and vijnana, discriminative consciousness, is perishable. It doesn't remain. Because vijnana is confined to the separation between self and not self. Otherwise there's no vijnana. But then for that super state, he says, vijnanam anidassanam anantam sabbato bhavam. Discriminative consciousness, he uses the same formula, anidassanam, which is characterless, invisible, anantam, which is endless, infinite, therefore, non-finite, non-measurable, sabbato, pabham, everywhere accessible. Pabham is shining, lucid. Pahang, which you find in the Diga, is shining. In the Diga Nikaya, I mean, you see. This is what he says. But you see, it is in words of that type that the inexpressible the attempt was made to express the inexpressible. In the Upanishads, they used a better trick. I'm using the word trick, not meaning it was a trick. It's a very serious thing. They used the simple word Atma. You see? They had their words for consciousness and mind and thought and attention and all the rest of it, you see. Manas and chitta and so forth and so forth. But they used the word Atma, the single word, to stand for that phrase which the Buddha uses. Vijnanam anidassanam anantam sabbato bhavam. You see? So now, this pulsation of life, other life. Into that which is a being, perishable, mortal, goes into that which is non-being, imperishable, eternal, if you like. You see? Immortal, birthless, deathless, and so forth. And this pulsation goes on continuously. Because if there is a pulsation, there is the movement. And the movement is between manifestation and the going out of all manifestation. So you see, our mortal concept of perpetuity doesn't hold where ultimate reality is concerned. Our mortal concept of death in the sense of annihilation also doesn't hold in that immortal context. This is the marvel of it all. Now, if the intellect can get hold of these to help, and this profounder depth of consciousness becomes aware of the significance, the living significance of what the intellect can tell us, then you are centered in the deathless reality. That is your starting point. But the word starting is misleading. It means as if you are going to move through time. But what can I do? Language is such a limited thing. I can do the best I can to make it lucid. Once you get that, the whole thing is there. Now, what we call our spiritual and mental growth and all that takes place in the real sense. But this growth is not confined to us. Because whatsoever happens to us, as we say, individually and separately, in this religious sense, because it is the transcendent context and sense, because it is the total context and sense, it affects the totality. You and I can't see how it affects the totality. Neither the Buddha, nor Jesus, nor the innumerable holy ones who have lived through the past. The Buddha himself, for instance, gives a list of 104 names in the Majjhima. You'll find it in the Isigili Sutta. 104 names of the perfected holy ones, you see. And the Upanishads give also a long list of names. And Saint Luke, in his genealogy of Jesus, don't think that they were the fleshly father and son, gives that wonderful list of the father of Jesus, the father of Joseph, and so forth, right up to Adam, which was the son of God. This was their way of telling us that there were those through whom these extraordinary realizations were manifest on earth amongst men. You see? So now, we'll try an experiment. And we'll start the experiment in the very sound psychological way that the Buddha taught. Let the mind be free of any sort of passionate desire, any sort of longing for this, that, or the other, the disturbance of the sense pleasures and so forth. Free of malevolence, enmity, ill will. Let it all drop away. Free of worry and flurry. Body and mind perfectly calm. And free of sloth and torpor. This is very essential here. you want to rev up the engines. You want to work up the steam. But under perfect control, this is the point. No sloth and torpor. The mind's going to be fully active, vibrate as it has never vibrated before. And have no doubt. Faith is in transcendence itself. One puts one's trust in transcendence, not in passing manifestations, persons, things, ideas, and so forth. Because then the faith vanishes with the death of the person and so forth and so forth. Or with the memory or whatever it is. Faith is in transcendence. So there is no doubt then. The mind be free of all that. Just be happy. Poised. Now let the rhythm of the breath establish itself. And we'll spend a few minutes perfectly quietly letting the mind vibrate in tune with. It can't possibly do it at the rapidity of the actual reality. In tune with this extraordinary pulsation, which is the fact of the universe itself, this pulsation between life and other life. Take note of any sensations, bodily sensations, if the mind does concentrate strongly on it, on this. You may find the tendency to breathe very deeply, or the heart beats faster. Just be careful of those little things. Or a throbbing feeling in the head and so forth. Just let the rhythm of the breath go on quietly. And psychologically, you may notice an intensely purifying influence, or it may be a disturbing influence. But it will come home to every one of us, how indispensable is the basis of all this in practice. And that basis is the Silas, pure morality. Perfect morality. And if you can become, if you can wake up to this extraordinary creative pulsation between of life, other life, if you can really respond to it, you will see that this morality is free of the sphere of ambivalence, There is no love, hate, kindness, cruelty, duality implied in, involved in it. This which starts in the ambivalent sphere, because we are in the state of avidya, ignorance, this which starts in the ambivalent sphere drops off all its ambivalence and becomes the transcendent reality. What theistic religions have called divine love or wisdom or truth and so forth. What Buddhism has called Mahakaruna, Mahaprajna and so forth. But if this happens within oneself, then it's the sign that transcendence itself functions through you, the living being, the living organism. It comes only in flashes. But there comes the state, the stage, when instead of intermittent flashes, it becomes the permanent condition. Recall the words of the Buddha to Aggivesana. His other name is Satchaka, who was a Jain. And when the Buddha delivers a long discourse to him, at the end of it, he mentions this. That when he gives a talk to large numbers of people, each person in the audience thinks that the Buddha has spoken specially to him to solve his particular difficulties, answered his particular problems. And the Buddha says, no, that is not the way to look at it. The talk is for general instruction, which means that he touched upon the basic realities and principles involved. And then he ends up by saying, after such a talk, he steadies and calms his mind, and he enters into the samadhi nimitta, which the commentary on the Majjhima says stands for what is called the shunyata phala samadhi. Samadhi, the state of communion, concentration, if you like to use that word, the state of concentration on the fruit of voidness. Now do remember this. What is the mind void of? Greed, hate, delusion, ambition, as also of all what we in our ambivalent sphere, the good qualities. The mind is void of all that. And if the mind is void of all that, what is the fruit of it? The fruit of it is this attunement with this tremendous creative pulse of the universe itself, which, in terms of mind only, the Buddha described as, or mentioned as, I should say, the vinyanam anidassanam anantam sabbato papam. So that was the fruit of the voidness. And he says, his last words in that connection are, he enters into that state in which I ever constantly abide. Very significant. So you see, there we have the great hint, the great secret given out of how the perfected Holy One lives in his own inner being all the time. So that's why I said that what comes as flashes becomes the permanent reality. I have to use a word like permanent, but all words are misleading in some way or other, because there is an opposite to permanent, the impermanent. One can put it in these terms. In that state, the relative, which consists of the duals, sometimes, usually in opposition, sometimes in harmony. The relative is totally transcended and the absolute is there. The absolute fact. Those are the only words we humans can use. But this means the complete and full fruition of man as a religious being, and in such a being, the social sense has touched its zenith.